Thank you for joining me this evening, an important show as we discuss for the remainder of this hour how the police generate false confessions. We'll open up the phone line. If you have questions and concerns for our guests, you can do that at the bottom of the hour. Then in hours 3 and 4 of the show, Dr. Joe Alton joins us, and we'll discuss how to survive a mass shooting. That's what's coming up tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Right now, we're talking with James Trainum, and in his book, he reveals how innocent people can become suspects and then confessed criminals, even when they haven't committed a crime. He uses real stories. He looks at the inherent coerciveness of the interrogation process and why so many false confessions contain so many of the details that only the true perpetrator should know. We'll talk about that and more. Let's discuss real quickly, James. Before the break, I asked, what about training? Aren't police officers trained in the proper interrogation methods so that they don't make these mistakes and give loopholes to the guilty and create false information for the innocent?
No. Basically, the interrogation schools that are out there only maybe a couple of hours to a couple of days, maybe 3 or 4 days long. The leading interrogation school, I have to give them some props. The Reed school that teaches the Reed technique, that's the most commonly used technique across the country, and most interrogation schools teach a version of it. They, in their textbook, because they finally have admitted that, yes, false confessions can occur, in their textbook and on their website, they have a lot of good information about tactics that should be avoided, caution that should be used for certain suspects, and how to corroborate the steps that should be taken after the confession to confirm the reliability. The problem is it never reaches the classroom. Those topics are never brought up, and if you hear the word false confession in their classroom, it's because you didn't go to the bathroom or you didn't blink. It's just not emphasized. In my opinion, interrogation training in this country, it's like a doctor receiving training on a medical procedure, but not being taught anything about the side effects, how to recognize them, or how to treat them. So, no, training is really not helping.
All right. When we return, the book mentions different types of false confessions. We'll explore those with our guest, James Trainum, when we return to Coast AM. The book is called How the Police Generate False Confessions. The author, James Trainum, is with us. The book mentions different types of false confessions. James, can you give us an outline? What are the different styles?
Now, I cover it in two different areas in the book. One is I talk about voluntary, coerced, and internalized, and the other I talk about different types of unreliable. Which one would you like me to...
Let's cover them all. I think the listeners would love to know that.
Okay. Well, first off, when it comes to false confessions themselves, we already talked about the voluntary ones. There's the classification that they call the coerced ones, which is the person knows that they are falsely confessing, but they are doing so because they know that by doing that, they're going to get some sort of benefit from the detective. And the third, which is a really interesting one, is the internalized. Because of the techniques that the detective uses, the person begins to distrust their memory. And for a while, if not longer, they actually believe that they may have committed that crime. This can be done by the detective suggesting that maybe they blacked out, by lying about evidence. Look, we got 15 witnesses that saw you there. Maybe you blacked out. Maybe, you know, that sort of thing. So the person actually believes that they may have committed the crime. The other thing I talk about is that there's different types of what I call unreliable statement evidence. And these can be created by the, not totally false, but because of the way that we unintentionally contaminate the interrogation, it's just unreliable. And of course, the first one is a totally false statement. And the second is you can actually have a person who really did the crime, who confesses to it, but because of the way that the interrogation was done, and there is so much contamination, just like with the Brendan, you know, Daphne case, where the detective feeds the person so much information that it's impossible to tell where the information came from. So the statement itself is nullified because of this contamination. we've had statements that will criminalize a non-criminal act. This happens a lot in shaken baby cases where the doctor may misdiagnose the baby's death as a result of shaken baby. And so the detective goes in with the intent to get a confession from the mother that she shook the baby, even though that shaking never occurred. And so the mom's trying to think, oh, my God, I got to figure out what happened so I can help my child so my other children won't be taken away from me. Maybe I did shake, or maybe I put my baby down a little bit too hard right then. So, you know, that it happens quite a lot. And a lot of times I've seen confession or statements from good suspects that contain false elements of the crime. It's because the detective believed that that happened, even though it didn't, and he convinces the suspect in order to get the benefit that they have to include that in their confession. And that's an interesting dynamic. And where that occurs is actually the mindset of the detective going into the interrogation room themselves. They are convinced. They're told that you should not interrogate somebody unless you believe that they're guilty. So when they go into the interrogation room, they believe that they're guilty. They believe a certain series of events took place. In order for the person to get the benefit, they have to admit to those events. But what if the detective has it wrong? What if A and B did not happen? But you'll see it included in the interrogation. And that's a really good sign.
Well, isn't it interesting that happens in court, James? If the attorney is feeding information, it's stricken because you're leading the witness.
That's exactly right.
But yet it seems like that's just an everyday occurrence when it comes to the admission or the confession aspect of it. Is them trying to, I'm sure, to cut corners, the police are like, listen, this is what happened. This is how it went down. Is that pretty fair to say? And instead of giving the suspect an opportunity to give them that information, they're putting it out there and just making it easier for the person that is already feeling broken down or in a tight spot. Now they've got something to cling to.
Yes, absolutely. That's one way that contamination takes place. Another way is like they'll show them crime scene photos. If you show me a crime scene photo and then later on I describe to you the crime scene, that's no good because I could have gotten it from the crime scene photo. But yes, way too often, we'll just sit there and we'll tell them, look, we know what happened. This is it. Isn't that right? And the person will just agree to it and we'll accept that as a reliable confession, even though it reeks of contamination. They're supposed to be giving us the information, not the other way around. However, the way a interrogation is designed, the detective does 90% of the talking. And that's not a good way to get information.
I was watching one of the specials on ID, and I've mentioned this before, but I was so fascinated by this case. And these two women detectives were trying to break down this crime that had occurred. On Christmas morning, this woman's boyfriend, his brother, and nephew showed up to the house. The nephew goes into the restroom and finds the woman bound and gagged and murdered in the bathtub. And the detectives, you know, to their credit, they were great on the episode because they showed how fallible they were. They bring in this boyfriend, and obviously it looks like he did it. It's in his house, in his bathroom. And he's very cold and calculating through this whole thing. And they're questioning him, and he's showing no emotion about this brutal murder that took place in his house. And they, you know, the detective's like, we knew we had our guy. And they eventually do a swab and DNA test and everything, and he comes back clear. He wasn't the guy. Wasn't the guy. And he said during the interrogation, you know, you can't find me guilty just because this is how I process grief. And, you know, we were about to break up anyway. This is, yeah, it sucks, but, you know, I'm over her anyway. And then they did that not once, but I think there were four suspects. And each one, they'd be like, now we knew we had our guy. And then they'd do the DNA swab, and it was wrong. And then the final guy, they pin him to it, and they're like, he goes, and everybody else was fighting the idea of turning over any information or doing DNA swabs, even though they were innocent. They were fighting those aspects of it. And then this last guy's like, yeah, here's my phone, swab me. And they kind of throw their arms up like, yeah, here's another loose end. And the guy's got the photographs of the entire murder in his phone, and the DNA comes flying back. So here's the one guy still denying he had anything to do with it, but he's willing to give up all the evidence, and nobody else would. It was the strangest case, but you see the frustration these detectives must go under, because you see people reacting and acting so strangely when it comes to this case that, you know, you can almost sympathize and empathize with how police officers have to do their job in these cases.
Oh, absolutely. But that brings up another problem, is this conception that detectives think that they can become human lie detectors. And a large part of interrogation training is this behavioral analysis training that is based on no scientific research or evidence whatsoever. And so they're taught that by watching the body language and all this other kind of stuff, that they can tell with 80 to 90% accuracy whether or not somebody's being deceptive. And all the independent research out there that's not done by the interrogation schools has shown that this just doesn't work. And so I'm going into an interrogation. I think somebody's guilty anyway. I'm going to see what I want to see. And way too often we think that, you know, people should act a certain way, and when they don't, that automatically makes them guilty. And that's just not the case. And your program there is a very good case study of that. People act differently. In some false confession cases, the suspect was identified as a suspect because they were too emotional. They weren't emotional enough. They went to the funeral. They didn't go to the funeral. I mean, you know.
Right, so they didn't cry. They didn't, right. They were laughing when they were at a funeral, or they did something that seemed uncharacteristic for the situation.
Right.
But if you saw most police officers at the side of a crime, they have what's known as gallows humor, right? And you would think, how could you talk or joke like this? You're dealing with dead people, children, women, brutally, you know, beaten here. But it's a coping mechanism. But yet, sure, if you are possibly under the scrutiny of the law, that coping mechanism isn't looked at it that way. You know, it's looked at as a form or an admission of guilt.
And that's where tunnel vision falls in, because when I have tunnel vision, if I'm convinced that you're guilty, I'm going to look for signs of that that confirm that, rather than be neutral. What you say or what you do, I'm going to look at through a guilt presumptive lens. And it's very, very hard to guard against that. But it's something that we need a lot more training and a lot more practice in law enforcement.
You know, we talked about the fact that, you know, you reluctantly admitted that, you know, if you are arrested for anything where they're coughing up your Miranda rights, you should always lawyer up, even if you're innocent, just to protect your own backside in these cases. And police then look at that as kind of an admission of guilt. But sure, Isn't the same said for the police officers that are fighting the use of videotaping, you know, all interrogations from start to finish? That sure looks hinky in their department. And right now there's a pretty big black eye on a lot of law enforcement because of some of these rogue cops and bad cops out there. You would think they would do everything they possibly can to protect their rights as well as police officers, and not have to face internal affairs and the scrutiny of the media if they've got a great airtight case from start to finish of how they handled that interrogation. It would only behoove them in the end.
Yes, and a lot of them feel that way. However, they had the same excuses that they had when Miranda came out. Oh, we'll never get another confession. The videotape is going to inhibit the person. And study after study has shown that it is just not true. However, way too many law enforcement officials have told me privately, and I've also stated publicly, and I give an example in my book, where the reason we don't want to videotape is the suspect will sometimes say things that will, you know, nullify or cause problems for us down the road, and we just don't want to bring that stuff before the jury. Well, that is against the law. That's called what they call a Brady violation. You're supposed to turn over anything that's exculpatory to the defense attorney. And what these guys are admitting, they probably don't understand their Brady obligations, but what they're admitting is that they want to keep what goes on in that interrogation room out of the eyes of the jury because they think it's going to help them. When in reality, if they do it right, and they do a good job, they're going to have such a solid case that they don't have anything to worry about.
It's frightening when you look at the entire scope of the justice system that it comes down to this. That, and again, and I want people to realize too, you didn't write this book to be an instigator or cause problems for the law enforcement officials and police officers. You're just showing some of the inherent issues and flaws in the system the way it currently works.
That's correct. And the thing about it is, I'm all about building the best case possible. Mm-hmm. I want the bad guy off the street, but it has to be the right guy and it has to be done the right way. Once you start shaving corners, once you start, taking the shortcuts, eventually, well, first off, there's a good chance that you're going to lose the case to begin with. But second, sooner or later, you're going to get the wrong guy. And I do have in my book a lot of suggestions for improving the system and for reform. So, like I said, I wrote the book trying to improve things. And there's a lot of good cops out there that are going to read it, that are going to take it to heart, and that are going to be better interrogators because of it.
When people talk about false confessions, the media brings up the Reed technique a lot. Can you briefly explain that to us and how it's supposed to work?
Sure. Reed is, like I said, the oldest interrogation school in the U.S. It was they came to being after the courts started to suppress confessions because of the third degree. And they basically developed this two-step program. Where it's the first one is an interview where you use all this behavioral analysis stuff. And then once you've made the determination that the person in your mind is guilty, then you move into the interrogation. And the interrogation, like I said, it's a monologue. And I can briefly run through in a couple of minutes, if you like.
We've got about two and a half minutes before the break here.
Okay. Well, basically, you start off by telling the person that you absolutely positively know that they're guilty and that there's nothing that they could say that will change your mind. You then start to give them excuses, themes, like that we know you did it, we just want to know why. Did you do it because? And these themes oftentimes, unfortunately, though Reed says you shouldn't, will include some kind of suggestion of leniency. Anytime that you try to deny, I'm not supposed to let you deny. I'm supposed to block it and throw another theme out there. I can lie about the evidence. I can say that we got witnesses, we got videotape, we got all this other stuff that points to you committing the crime. Now, after I do this, and like I said, every time you deny, I'm going to throw a new theme at you, another theme, and another theme. I'm going to get you to the point where you're just downtrodden and you feel hopeless. So at that point, I will say, look, you either did it for a really bad reason or you did it for a less bad reason. It's one or the other. It was either you planned it or it was spur of the moment. What was it? Planned, spur of the moment. So you're given only two options. At that point, we hope that you take one of the options. You go, yeah, you're right, I did it. And then after you make the admission, that's when I'm supposed to get those details from you that I can later go out and corroborate. So even though people are saying that, oh, I'm just looking for the truth, the way that the interrogation is structured, they're looking for an admission to what the detective believes to be the truth. And that's the pretty much the standard right there. That is a typical Reed interrogation.
On the other side, you know, I've got some friends that are cops that have said they've had to sit there and in order to gain the trust and friendship, if you will, of these criminals, sometimes they have to sit there and relate to, you know, hey, I understand why you did what you, the kid is good looking. Why wouldn't you want to touch him? You know, and they have to kind of take on this, oh yeah, I totally understand. And they say that makes them feel just so disgusting having to do that. But sometimes it's that angle that gets the perpetrator relaxed enough to talk and open up about, yeah, well, yeah, you mean others feel like this? And they kind of open up. Does that really work?
It can, and that's one of the themes that you could throw out there for somebody who's involved in that sort of offense. Now, this is not to say that Reed is not a very effective interrogation techniques. It is extremely effective. It does get good confessions. The problem is that it's too effective, and it can lead somebody who is innocent to confessing to a crime that they didn't commit. But
James Tranum, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more when we return to Coast AM. James Trainum, our guest for the remainder of this hour. We're going to take your phone calls and continue on with the show. I'm filling in tonight, of course, for George Norrie. And if you want to see George live, he's got a show coming up in Asheville, North Carolina, August 27th. You can check out all the information, full information about this amazing program, live event, and there's very few tickets that still remain, but be a part of it. You can go on out and hang out with George Norrie, hear him live, along with some other fantastic guests. All that information is at coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. Go check it out while you're there. My name is Dave Schrader. I'm your interim host this evening, and if you're interested in topics like this, you can join me on my show Monday through Friday from 9 p.m. till midnight as we explore the strange and unusual world around us on Darkness Radio. You can find more information at darknessradio.com. And for those of you in the UP, I'm going to be in Michigan at the end of this week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday I'll be at the Kewadin Casino. The great Michigan Paracon is going to be taking on. Celebrities from all of your favorite paranormal shows and more will be on hand. You can find information about that at darknessevents.com. Darknessevents.com. James Trainum, our guest right now. I do have a question for you, James. A lot of the courts have recognized, and they've already accepted, that interrogations are inherently kind of coercive. What else can they do? What else can we do to get a confession that doesn't already fall into the parameters and the flawed system that we have in place now?
Well, actually, in the UK, they were facing the same dilemma that we are facing now several years ago. They realized that the techniques that they were using, which were our techniques, were resulting in false confessions. So they scrapped everything. In the UK, it is now against the law to use something like the Reed technique and the very techniques that I was talking about. They developed an entirely different approach where they don't interrogate. They interview in a way that is designed to convince the person to talk to them and to provide them as much information as possible. It's extremely effective. These mega studies have shown that it's just as effective, if not more so, than what we do here in the U.S. And it minimizes the problem of contamination and false confessions. The problem for us is that it's a lot of training and also a lot more investigative work, but you build a lot better case with it, not only with confessions, but also with witnesses and victims. And
a lot of
places in Canada, they're starting to adopt it, and they're looking at it here as well.
And you talk about an alternative to interrogation in the book. Can you give us just a brief idea of what that is and how it would work?
Sure. It's actually called PEACE, and that's kind of a bad name for law enforcement. We like much tougher names, but it's an acronym for the different planning stages. And basically what I do is I encourage you, look, I am investigating this. You are a suspect. I would like to know everything about what you did that day. And what I'm seeking from them is an open narrative. I want them to give me information. So let's say that I suspect that the person was involved in a murder because their car was captured in a red light camera speeding away from the crime scene. Well, one of the things I want to do is I want to find out where they were that day. So I'm going to ask them in an open question, tell me where you were that day. I'm then going to ask about their car. And this is very, very simplistic, by the way. I'm asking about their car. Does anybody else drive your car? Did you drive your car that day? Does anybody else have keys to your car? Does anybody else have access to your car? So finally, after you've lied to me about all these things, I'm going to then say, okay, can you account for the fact that we have your car on camera at the crime scene X blocks away? Well, I've already boxed you in. I've already gotten all this information, and nobody drives your car, has access to your car, and now you're faced with having to explain why your car was there. So even if I don't get a confession, I've gotten so much great information and so many great lies that I can prove are lies, that it's just as good as a confession. And like I said, I haven't contaminated, I haven't used coercive interrogation techniques, so it's going to be accurate, reliable, and admissible.
All right, we need to take our final break. When we come back, your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back, and speaking with James Tranum, his book, How the Police Generate False Confessions. Let's go to the phone lines. Wildcard, Line 1, Jay in Irondale. You're on with us.
Hello. Greetings, Shabbat Shalom. And I'm grateful that you had this show. As an experienced paralegal, I can tell you that the system is real crooked. And a suggestion, if the police come to your property, you do not have to open your door. Don't be intimidated by them. Open the window and talk to them. If they say, we need you to come down, we need to interview you, interview and interrogation are not too far apart. I mean, let's face it. They will do anything to hold you. As a person who has been thrown in jail for false arrest and false imprisonment, which is rampant today, I can tell you that, and by the way, everything that I've ever been accused of has been thrown out. They see me coming, they go, well, not him. But if you
all right, hold on a second, Jay. James, as somebody who's actually worked in the system, is what our caller saying the truth, or is this kind of a skewed perspective?
It's both. Because I know that there's a lot of very dedicated, very good law enforcement officers out there who are trying to do a good job. However, some of the pressures and things that they're under, we tend to, like I said, unfortunately cut corners, and we're a little more aggressive at times than we should. So I'm sure that he's had these experiences, and I'm sure that a lot of people have, but and his advice is good advice. However, like I said, I don't want to distract from the officers out there who are trying to follow the rules and trying to do the right thing.
All right. Well, thank you, Jay. Let's go to Wildcard Line 2. Carol in Bismarck, North Dakota, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. And I want to ask you if lack of respect for women in one's financial status has any bearing to do with how they're treated when you're either reporting a crime or you're being suspected of one. And possibly maybe that's a reason why a lot of people don't come forward, because when they come forward to give information, sometimes they're not treated very well. And I also want to say Shabbat Shalom also.
All right, James, where do you weigh in on that? Do you think that that has an effect?
I think it has an effect with individual officers who deal with people, but also, unfortunately, for law enforcement as a whole. We have been finding, especially with the unrest that we've had recently, that poor communities, minority communities, often aren't treated the same as other, you know, more wealthy communities in the system. And it's something that has not been addressed for decades, and it's something that we absolutely need to get better at.
Shouldn't there be an automatic rule in play that children, anybody under the age of 18 or whatever the legal age of adulthood is in a state, there should be no questioning of them, period, unless there is an attorney and a parent involved in the interrogation process, because it seems like that would eliminate a lot of problems right there if there was just a blanket rule that played into effect.
And there is a proposed law, I believe, in California right now that would demand that an attorney be consulted during at least the reading of the Miranda rights. Unfortunately for law enforcement, they're right in that if that rule was in place, if an attorney had to be there, they would never, ever be able to interrogate anybody under that age, simply because no attorney worth their salt is ever going to let their client be interrogated. In the UK, they have a process by what they call, they use an appropriate adult. That's an independent person who's not law enforcement, who's there when they have a vulnerable suspect, like a juvenile or somebody with a cognitive issue. And they're there to make sure that they fully understand what their rights are and that they are treated well. And so they're not an attorney, but they're an independent observer. Where the law enforcement is going to fight that your proposal tooth and nail, this may be something that they're more open to, because it goes to protecting the juvenile's rights, but it also gives them the opportunity to try to get information to help solve a crime.
Wildcard Line 3, Gary in Santa Maria, California. You're on the air.
Oh, this subject sets me right on fire. 30 seconds of quick background. My godfather and my father were both with LAPD. My godfather became deputy chief of all of LAPD, 10,000 man strong. The riots happened in 1992. He was sued for $1 million for not deploying, personally sued himself, for not deploying enough officers at the start of that riot. I volunteered to rebuild LA on the Communications and Race Relations Task Force. I never missed a meeting in 2.5 years. Nobody knew that Ron Frankel, deputy chief, was my godfather. Better than being an absolute sibling or having a parent as a chief of police, because the only record is within the church. I applied everything I had. $4 billion was spent trying to figure out what the problem was in the race relation. They had a former baseball commissioner who lived in Marina Del Rey at the top of that, and he was worthless. We came back with a report that showed it was the war on drugs has perverted the entire system. It is worse now than it was in 1992. Nobody did a thing about it. They keep their checks and balances. The drug war is the moneymaker for the police department. It's how they militarize up, and they are in a war, and it is getting bloodier by the moment. This war on drugs is the most asinine thing. If you agree with the war on drugs, answer this question. How much would you have to escalate it to win it? If we cannot keep drugs out of our prison, how in the heck are you going to keep them out of people's homes and family? The whole purpose is to get somebody on probation. Cops will do everything in their power to trick you out of your rights so they can get a bust. The public defender will plea bargain you down. Part of that plea bargain will be that you have to give your consent to be searched the next time. You rack up a couple of arrests for minor possession, dealing to your friends. Now they will turn you into an informant to keep you out of state prison. If you are not found out as an informant and it escalates and it has perverted the entire system of our police force, and it's sad. We got to give up on this silly drug war, people. And
right,
I'm looking
Gary,
forward to your response.
Thank you for calling in, Gary. What do you make of that, James?
Well, sir, one of the things that the drug war has done is it's overwhelmed the law enforcement and the court system, and it's also kind of dehumanized a lot of the people that we serve and that we come in contact with in our eyes, and they become numbers. And because not only do we have an increase in numbers of arrests, but we have an increase in expectation of arrest on us. And so therefore, like I said, that's when, because we're under these pressures, we unfortunately start cutting corners when it comes to investigations, dealing with witnesses, dealing with informants. And that's how bad confessions, bad witness statements, and bad informant stuff occurs. And so, yeah, I mean, it all plays into it. And definitely by getting away from this overemphasis on stats, on number of arrests, on number of convictions, of getting cases done quickly and simply, it will definitely increase the quality of law enforcement overall. So I do agree that the war on drugs is actually, I've seen it ruin good investigative work in my career.
Well, and it's got to get to the point, too, where people have to start taking some responsibility for their lives, and the fact that if you want better police work and you want cops that are not under this pressure and this buckling, it starts at home. Start talking to your children. Start talking to the people that you care about now to curb the crime and stop this. Because if they're spending so much time chasing every insane, stupid crime out there, how can they be effective on the important crimes when their time and efforts are being split so much. I mean, that's got to be part of the breaking system for the legal system as well. When there's so much going on, you can't be a master or a slave to many masters in that kind of sense, because you can't commit to any one thing to make it really work.
And the other thing is, yes, we definitely need to have a better relationship with the community so that we're able to get information voluntarily from witnesses and other people like that without having to resort to these coercive interview and interrogation techniques, because that's where the problem comes in.
Right.
You get a witness, you treat them badly, you get the information that you need, but they're no longer good to anybody in the future because they're not going to trust anybody. They're not going to come forward. So it's a vicious circle.
Wildcard line four, Deborah in Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was so into that last caller because it sounds so familiar to me. And I actually am in the DFW area, but all of what I wanted to talk about happened in Taylor County, Abilene, Texas. And you said you didn't understand about people and false confessions. Well, I want to tell you there's something that goes on, and it's to do with our children. And I got myself, I guess, on the bad side of police because I turned in some police that my patients were telling me were where they were getting drugs and weapons. And I thought it was the right thing to do to write to the FBI and to the Texas Rangers and let them know, would they check it out? Because I myself have never used drugs, so I didn't know. I just wanted, if it was true, please clean it up. If not, thank you for checking. Well, they told the police it was me. And then all hell broke loose on my life, a lot of things. But the worst thing that happened, well, this is not the worst thing, but one bad thing is as soon as our son turned 15 years old, he got a phone call from the one person that he had met and befriended in that town because he hadn't been there with me working in that town very long. And he walked across the street, saw the friend who called him pull out a gun and shoot at someone, and the other person shot back, killing his friend. And so my son ran, and the police charged my son with the murder, even though I believe all those other people there were police in street clothes. My son, we didn't know it, that many people in the town, and he didn't know who they were. But with no evidence whatsoever, no gunpowder residue on his hands, clothes, no fingerprints, no DNA, none of his, nothing. And they took him to jail, kept him, and wouldn't let me go in to see him all night. And early in the morning, so this went on all night with them interrogating him with guns. He said, well, I'll tell you what happened, but I didn't do it. And they knew he didn't do it. But and he said he'd take a polygraph test. But the thing about it is they kept him up all night. Then they kept him locked in jail with no bail, even though we had paid this lawyer almost $100,000 that he demanded to represent our son, because I guess we don't get any innocent till proven guilty. And so the thing that happened is my son, up until the last day.
Deborah, we've got about 20 seconds. You need to wrap it up.
Okay, well, he got sent to prison. They gave him a drink in that room back there, and my son, 3 days later, didn't remember that he went out there and confessed. I believe they gave him a date rape drug because he walked out like a robot. But my point is, that's one of the ways that they do it to kids.
All right, Deborah, thank you for calling in. We're sorry to hear that happened to you and your family. It's not a perfect system, James. I appreciate the work that you've done in putting yourself out on the line to write a book like this, to take a deeper look at the problems and the flaws in the system. Thank you very much for doing that, and thank you for serving and trying to keep people safe.
Well, thank you for having me. I do appreciate it.
James Trainum, How the Police Generate False Confessions. We'll have links and information about that up at Coast to Coast AM. You can check that out and get more information when we return. How do we survive a mass shooting? This is becoming more and more a weekly occurrence. What can we do to take ourselves out of the line of fire? We'll talk with Dr. Joe Alton when we return. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.